Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. This year, Democracy Now! Is celebrating our 25th anniversary. That's a quarter of a century of bringing you the voices and stories you won't hear anywhere else. Democracy Now! Has always refused to take government or corporate funding because nothing is more important to us than our editorial independence. But that means we rely on you, our audience, for support. Please visit democracynow.org right now to make your contribution and help us stay on the air for at least another 25 years. Thank you so much. Oh, and remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. Wearing two is even better. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It feels like a dream. Like, I was in the car and I was just like, this is finally happening. And I'm really going to be reunified with her after all these times. It was just like, they barely let me know this week. And it was just like, just literally 3-4 days ago. And I was just like, I can't believe it.
This week, four parents from Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico were reunited with their children in the United States in an effort by the Biden administration to bring together families separated under former President Trump. There are thousands more to go. We'll speak to Carol Ann Donahoe of El Otro Lado, an ACLU attorney, Legal Arndt, who was at one of the family reunifications.
It was incredibly emotional. The key now is, can we get this scaled up so we can get more than 1,000 families reunited and more than 5,500 children who have been separated, full relief.
Then to Julia Wright, the daughter of the celebrated African-American writer Richard Wright, the author of Native Son and Black Boy. He died over 60 years ago. But he has a new novel out, The Man Who Lived Underground. The manuscript was rejected by publishers in the 1940s because of its detailed descriptions of racist police violence. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has signed a sweeping voter suppression bill that would make it harder to vote by mail, limit ballot drop boxes, impose new voter ID requirements, and criminalize giving food and water to voters waiting in line at polling places. DeSantis signed the bill in a private ceremony Thursday that was broadcast on Fox and Friends. A spokesperson for the governor barred reporters and other camera crews from observing the ceremony, telling at least one reporter the event was a Fox News exclusive. DeSantis was surrounded by a group of Republican lawmakers, none of them African American.
Right now, I have what we think is the strongest election integrity measures in the country. I'm actually going to sign it right here. It's going to take effect.
So, there you go.
Bill is signed.
Florida State Senator Chevron Jones responded, quote, "This blatant voter suppression is Jim Crow 2.0 and will make it harder for voters from low-income rural white communities to the elderly to communities of color to have their voices heard. It's clearly part of a coordinated, targeted assault strategy as Florida joins a long list of states pursuing disenfranchisement efforts in recent months," she said. This comes as Texas's House of Representatives early this morning passed a Republican-backed voter suppression bill after an all-night session. The House bill will have to be reconciled with a Senate voter suppression bill before heading to the desk of Republican Governor Greg Abbott, who has signaled he'll sign the legislation. Meanwhile, Republicans in Ohio have introduced a bill that would put severe restrictions on ballot drop boxes and absentee voting. In international news, India reported nearly 4,000 COVID-19 deaths Friday, with over 414,000 new infections, breaking the world record it set one day earlier. In India's southwestern state of Goa, more than half of all people tested have coronavirus infections, one of the highest positivity rates of the pandemic. Japan's extended a nationwide state of emergency as infections surged less than 80 days before the start of the the Olympics. An online petition titled Cancel the Tokyo Olympics to Protect Our Lives gathered 250,000 signatures in its first 2 days. Meanwhile, a new study from the University of Washington estimates the true toll of the pandemic is far higher than governments have reported. Researchers at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation say COVID-19 has caused about 6.9 million deaths worldwide, more than double the official figure. Topping the list is the United States, with over 900,000 estimated deaths, followed by India, with more than 650,000 deaths. The researchers projected about 600,000 deaths each in Mexico, Brazil, and Russia. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said Thursday she opposes a push at the World Trade Organization to waive patent rights for COVID-19 vaccines. Since the WTO operates by consensus, Germany's opposition could derail efforts to transfer vaccine technology to factories in places like India and Brazil. Over 100 nations, led by South Africa and India, say the move is desperately needed to increase the availability of vaccines in the global south. They were given a boost Wednesday when President Biden said he would no longer oppose a waiver. French President Emmanuel Macron on Thursday joined the call to waive patent rights on COVID vaccines, while European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the 27-nation bloc was open to debate on the issue.
The European Union is also ready to discuss any proposal that address the crisis in an effective and pragmatic manner. And that's why we are ready to discuss how the U.S. proposal for waiver on intellectual property protection for COVID vaccines could help achieve that objective.
In Brazil, at least 25 people were killed Thursday as heavily armed police raided one of Rio de Janeiro's largest favelas. The assault by anti-narcotics officers came despite a Brazilian Supreme Court order prohibiting such raids during the pandemic. It was the deadliest single police assault in Rio's history. Residents of the Jacarezinho favela said police arrived with guns blazing.
They pointed a gun at me with a rifle. They told me that I had to die because I went to talk to them, just because I asked where my son's body was. They pointed a gun at me.
Did your child die today?
He died. They arrived shooting.
Human rights groups condemned the raid as a massacre with clear signs of execution-style killing, citing video showing blood-stained mattresses and blood-soaked stairwells. Two passengers on a passing commuter train were injured by stray gunfire. Amnesty International said, quote, it's completely unacceptable that security forces keep committing grave human rights violations against residents of the favelas who are mostly black and live in poverty. The Pentagon sent military enforcements to Afghanistan to oversee the withdrawal of U.S. and coalition forces. President Biden announced U.S. troops will be out of Afghanistan by September 11th, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. But violence has been surging in the already volatile country in recent weeks as the Taliban condemned the U.S. failure to respect the earlier May 1st deadline for pullout agreed to by President Trump. The New York Times reports at least 139 government forces and 44 civilians were killed in the past week, the highest weekly death toll since October. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch is warning Afghan women's access to health care is at risk due to cuts in international aid. The group said, quote, donors are locked in a waiting game to see whether the withdrawal of foreign troops will result in the Taliban gaining greater control of the country. But this is no excuse for cutting funds for essential services that aid groups have managed to deliver in insecure and Taliban-controlled areas, they said. In Virginia, Code Pink co-founder Medea Benjamin interrupted a shareholder meeting of General Dynamics Wednesday to protest the company's arms sales to Saudi Arabia and other countries. Medea Benjamin addressed General Dynamics CEO Phoebe Novacek, who she says has personally pocketed $21 million a year.
So if you have a model where you need a global conflict, where you need wars to be able to make money, I think there's something fundamentally wrong with this company, and you ought to have some more moral reflection about how you earn your billions of dollars.
The Justice Department is warning Arizona's Republican-ordered recount of the 2020 presidential election. Results in Maricopa County could be violating federal voting and civil rights laws. Arizona Secretary of State Katie Hobbs said observers have witnessed ballots and laptops left unattended and untrained workers using inconsistent procedures. The private company hired by the Arizona Republican Party to carry out the audit, called Cyber Ninjas, also says it has been directly contacting voters to verify voter registrations, which could constitute voter intimidation. In addition, Cyber Ninjas, whose CEO has openly promoted conspiracy theories about the election, including from prominent QAnon figures, is far behind the May 14th deadline to finish the audit. As of Wednesday, only about 10% of the 2.1 million ballots had been counted. The Veterans Memorial Coliseum at the Arizona State Fairgrounds said all elections materials must be vacated May 14th, but auditors now say they will just pause, then resume the count if needed. Meanwhile, New York Congressmember Elise Stefanik, whom top Republicans have backed to replace Liz Cheney in her leadership role, said on Steve Bannon's podcast Thursday she supports the Arizona recount. A Colorado Republican lawmaker was reprimanded Thursday after he used a racist term during a debate in the Colorado General Assembly. Representative Richard Holtorf, who's white, referred to a colleague as buckwheat during Wednesday's legislative session.
I'm getting there. Don't worry, buckwheat. I'm getting there. What I'd like to say, that's an endearing term, by the way.
Representative Holtorf, we must maintain order in here and not refer to any individuals other than in any inappropriate manner.
Representative Leslie Herod, who is black, rushed to the podium to confront Holtorf over his racist remarks as the General Assembly broke for a recess. New York's attorney general says the nation's largest broadband companies funded a secret campaign to influence the Federal Communications Commission's repeal of net neutrality rules. Attorney General Letitia James said Thursday an investigation by her office found that, quote, the broadband industry hired marketing companies that co-opted and created identities and filed nearly 18 million fake comments with the FCC and sent over 500,000 fake letters to Congress in support of the repeal. Supporters of net neutrality say protections are needed to preserve an open internet and to bar internet service providers from stopping or slowing down the delivery of websites. Former Maldives President Mohamed Nasheed was injured in a suspected bomb attack Thursday. The 53-year-old Nasheed, who is the current speaker of the Maldives parliament, became the country's first democratically elected president in 2008, but was ousted in a 2012 coup and was granted asylum in Britain before he returned to the Maldives in 2018. He put the fight against the climate crisis front and center of his presidency and has been hailed as a climate hero. Thursday, Today's attack has sent shockwaves throughout the islands and is being investigated as an act of terrorism. To see our interviews with President Mohamed Nasheed, you can go to democracynow.org. And indigenous leaders and climate activists are holding a global day of action to halt and defund the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline in northern Minnesota. Protests are taking place at banks and cities across the country, as well as in Japan, Switzerland, Sierra Leone, Costa Rica, Canada, and across Europe. This is Jackie Fielder of Stop the Money Pipeline.
And so we have more than 50 actions across the U.S. and actions across seven other countries, as well as three other continents, protesting the banks that are underwriting loans to Enbridge, the company behind the Line 3 pipeline. Line 3 would result in an additional 193 million tons of greenhouse gases every single year, and it violates indigenous rights of the Anishinaabe people and their right to free prior and informed consent.
On Thursday, water protectors blockaded a so-called man camp at the Enbridge site to mark missing or murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit Awareness Week. Indigenous activists said, quote, the violence committed on our land becomes the violence committed on our people. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. When we come back, four parents from Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico were reunited this week with their children in the United States after being separated under the Trump administration. There are still thousands to go. Stay with us.
Diamantes cristalina no lo es, humilde hogar de lámina y cartón, estallan en el cerro con los rayos del sol. Nadie nos dará, gobierno majestad, la necesidad es ajena, no sienten mi pena. Nadie nos dará, gobierno majestad, la necesidad es ajena, no sienten mi pena. Allá donde no había, no solicito permiso para la vida, soy rica en esperanza, si de reto no me niego. Le daré vista, hasta el más ciego, soy rica en esperanza, si de reto no me niego.
Estoy aquí, I'm here by Quetzal. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Oh, you can sign up for our daily digest, our news email every day by texting the word Democracy Now!, one word, no space, to 66866. This week, four parents from Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico were reunited with their children in the United States after being separated under President Trump's zero-tolerance policy. They're the first families to be reunited on U.S. soil since the Biden administration began its reunification process. At least two of the mothers were separated from their children since 2017. Biden initially agreed to reunite 35 parents with their children out of more than 1,000 youths who remain separated. Immigrant Justice Group, Al Otro Lado in English, the other side, said the Department of Homeland Security did nothing to facilitate the return of the four parents, and that it was groups like theirs who had to negotiate the travel visas, pay for airline tickets, and actually arrange the reunifications. Al Otro Lado shared with us this video of 18-year-old Brian Chavez as he was reunited with his mother, Sandra Ortiz, this week. This came 3 years, 7 months, and 4 days after they were separated. In 2017, the last words Sandra heard before Customs and Border Protection officers took Brian away were, "Say goodbye to your son because you'll never see him again." Well, on Tuesday, Sandra and Brian embraced each other at the San Ysidro border crossing, the very same place where they were first separated, with Brian holding a bouquet of balloons that read, "Best mom ever."
It feels like a dream. Like, I was in the car and I was just like, this is finally happening. And I'm really going to be reunified with her after all these times. It was just like, they barely let me know this week. And it was just like, just literally 3-4 days ago. And I was just like, I can't believe it. You know, am I actually going to see her today or no? Because you never know. And I was in the car and I was just thinking, like, it just sounds unreal that I'm actually going to see her today after all these days, after been thinking every day, how is she doing? Like, I was talking to her on the phone and everything, but still not making sure, like, seeing her in person, being able to give her a hug and everything. It was just...
Does it feel like a dream?
Yes, it actually
does. End of a nightmare?
Yes.
That's 18-year-old Brian Chavez being reunited with his mother, Sandra Ortiz, on Tuesday. He'd been living with relatives in California, enrolled in high school after the U.S. deported his mother to Mexico when he was 15. Well, this Sunday is Mother's Day here in the United States. The holiday is celebrated Monday in Mexico, El Salvador, and Guatemala. For more, we're joined by Caroline Donahoe, managing attorney for El Otro Lado's Family Reunification Project, and Lee Gallant, deputy director of the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project and the attorney leading the ACLU's lawsuit over family separations. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! I wanted to begin with Carol Ann. Talk about this moment with Brian and his mother, this moment that has the country crying, both its poignancy and also why it took so long for them to come back together, more importantly, why they were separated to begin with.
Well, as far as this moment, as the reporter asked him, it's the end of a nightmare. It's the beginning of a dream. This is a culmination of years of trauma. And although we love to see the reunifications and they're very moving, we have to keep in mind what led to that and that it should never have happened in the first place, let alone what they're going to have to overcome in the years ahead to heal from everything that was done to them.
So can you explain what happened to Brian when he was 15 with his mother at that same port of entry?
Yeah, and that's one thing, Sandra, when we told her about the reunification, she didn't realize that she was going to be entering into the very same port of entry where she was separated from her son. So, and they were, they entered seeking asylum. They were separated after a couple of days. They were told, as you said, that she was said, told to say goodbye to her child, that they were told to say goodbye to their children. They weren't going to see them again. And according to Sandra, she said they were told, don't be emotional about it so that your kids don't react. And so for 2 weeks, she had no idea where he was. He had no idea what had happened to her. And then she was deported back to the harm that she fled. She's been in hiding ever since.
And how was it that they were reunited, Carol Ann Donahue?
Well, this is the culmination of years worth of effort and a lot of work done through the steering committee of the Mizzell litigation, other organizations on the ground. And Sandra was referred to us by the steering committee to represent her in her reunification. And that was July of 2020. So that's how long we've been representing her. The border was under Trump effectively closed. So it wasn't a question of being able to bring her there to the border like we had previously with a group of reunifying parents. And there was no way that the government was going to allow them in. So we had to ask them to be patient. And we have to remember that throughout that time, we all went through the pandemic. There was one mom who wasn't sure if she should just bring her child back to the farm because her father had died of COVID. And she said, what if I never see my child again? What if I die of COVID and I never see her again? They went through, endured two hurricanes in Honduras. We had to kind of wait holding our breath during the election to see the outcome of that before we could even have some semblance of hope. So once, once Biden was elected, and we have to, I have to be clear that if that were not the case, we would not be having this conversation right now. And we, as El Otro Lado, the families that we represent, we have been preparing for this moment. We've been just waiting for the okay so that when the time came where the government gave us the okay that they can be processed through the port of entry, we were ready. We had done the prep work, and they told us to give them 7 days notice, and we gave them 7 days notices that day.
So what happens now? Is Sandra allowed to stay in this country?
Well, what happens now is, of course, one of the biggest concerns. These parents will tell you that, you know, what they're concerned about are the other parents who are still separated from their children, and also the uncertainty around what will happen to them now. And, you know, we heard yesterday Secretary Mayorkas say that they're looking into legal permanent status, but that's not something that they can guarantee. And I can say that without permanent legal status, without some sort of guarantee that they're going to be able to stay and not have to go through our adversarial process, they're just going to be in limbo and continuously re-traumatized. And I just have to, you know, to center this, that the families are, it's easy to talk abstractly, but they were, according to Physicians for Human Rights' own report, they were tortured. And so we need to remedy the fact that our government tortured children and their mothers and their fathers. And so, unfortunately, there's not, the executive branch is limited in what they can do as far as giving permanent status. But there is Senator Blumenthal and Representative Castro just reintroduced the Families Belong Together Act, which would do a lot to remedy the harm. And so we'd ask Congress to act on that.
Legal, you have been working on this for years, since the families started getting separated, just like Alocha Lavo. Can you talk about, are we at this point talking about thousands more children?
Well, there were 5,500, at least 5,500 children separated by Trump. We believe that there are likely more than 1,000 who still need to be reunited. We have not even found the parents of 455 children, but our best estimate is now that, and the government has joined us in that estimate, is that there are likely more than 1,000 that will have to be reunited. So we are thrilled for these first four families. I was at one of the reunions in Philadelphia, and, you know, that kind of emotion is indescribable.
Can you describe that one to us, though?
Yeah, I mean, the best I can. There's a great New Yorker piece by Jonathan Blitzer doing it, and there's video out there people should look at on the New Yorker website. But, you know, it's just sort of, it's an intense emotional moment that I have not witnessed in my professional career outside of these reunifications. I think there's an element of, we may never have seen each other again. It's not just that they haven't seen each other for 3.5 years, but there's always that lingering thought all the time, we may never see each other again in person. And the mother who reunited in Philadelphia actually surprised her kids, and I was there and just walked in the door, and they hugged each other for what seemed like an eternity, just sobbing. And these were boys who were separated when they were teenagers and have now had to adjust to America on their own, the culture, the language, a strange place, with the trauma of being separated. And I have teenage boys, and I think it's hard enough in the best of circumstances, those years in a teenage boy's life, but to do it in a strange land without your mother is just unbelievable, a testament to this family that they've persevered. The big question now
is, in fact,
is,
we're showing the video of Mabel's children. They were 13 and 15. She came from Honduras. They were fleeing the violence there. She spent 2 years in ICE detention in El Paso, Texas, before being deported back to Honduras. The boys were in a detention center before ultimately ending up with a family in Philadelphia. As I look at it now, they cannot let go of their mother.
Exactly. Exactly.
So go ahead with what you were saying, Leigh.
Yeah. So I think, you know, now the question, of course, is going forward, hopefully the process that's been developed, we would have liked to have seen, obviously everyone would have liked to have seen it go quicker, but we are where we are. And hopefully the process the government's developed over this initial time is scalable, so the thousands the 1,000 more can be reunited much more quickly. But I think beyond reunification, what we are pressing for, the ACO is pressing for in these negotiations, we're trying to comprehensively settle our lawsuit against the Trump administration, is not just reunification, social services, including mental health trauma and other social services, compensation in the form of damages, and as Carol Ann said, most critically, legal permanent status. And we, you know, we'll never make these families whole again, but we have to try, and we have to give them permanency, legal status here, a safe place so that they can begin to overcome the trauma. The medical community has been so clear that without real care, these families may not stand a realistic chance of leading a healthy, productive life going forward.
I mean, like Sandra in San Ysidro at the port of entry, Mabel Gonzalez from Honduras can stay at least at this point for 3 years in Philadelphia with her boys. How are you pushing the Biden administration on this? I mean, it's been months and four families have been reunited, and you say there are over 1,000 to go. Also, is the government doing this? And let me put this question to Carol Ann Donahoe. Is the government doing this, or are your groups like El Otro Lado doing this? It sounds like you're paying for the reunification, and yet it was the government of the United States that separated them and did the damage.
Well, I just want to be clear that what we're referring to in that case are these particular families. Of the four that reunited this week, Al Otro Lado represented three, and they were all, although they were not all Mexican nationals, they were all in Mexico. So we did the legwork to get them there. And again, it was because we are, you know, in constant contact with these parents. We know and sense the urgency that not only is it torture for them to spend one more day without their children, but they are in physical danger. They're back to where they're in hiding. They're, you know, hiding from their persecutors. So we understood the urgency. And while, you know, we couldn't ask them to wait while policy and process was debated, so we just took that action. But going forward, as Lee said, they are working on a process for the larger group. We don't anticipate that that's going to be our role moving forward. But in this case, as I said, we just wanted to get them there as quickly as possible.
I wanted to go to the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, speaking to NBC News' Jacob Soboroff in an interview Thursday, that the Biden administration can't guarantee a path to permanent residency for families separated by Trump. This is what he said.
We are very much focused on providing stability to the reunited families, not just for her, but for the family as a unit. It's not something we can guarantee at this point in time, but we are dedicated to achieving more than what we have delivered thus far. This, I think, is a temporary measure. Unite the family, reunite the family, and then let's work together with those representing the family to see what we can achieve under the law, and I think what these families both need and deserve.
So today, the Department of Homeland Security will visit a tent facility for unaccompanied migrant children at the border in Donut, Texas. And this week, DHS released pictures of their tents there, which had previously been packed with children. Democratic Congressmember Henry Cuellar said the photos are misleading because the children are still at the same compound, but are now being held in tents run by DHHS, the Department of Health and Human Services. The news outlet Border Report visited the compound Wednesday and said it's now full of white tents and everything is surrounded by black fencing that prevents anyone outside from looking in. Lee Gallant, can you talk about this?
Yeah, I just want to return quickly to the prior segment. I mean, we are working with the government to do all these things on a scale of service, but they will ultimately pay for all the transportation, including reimbursing the NGOs that paid for these initial four. But beyond that, as to the unaccompanied minors who are coming and being held, we are very concerned with how they're being held. But we believe the Biden administration is starting to turn the corner. They got caught off guard by the numbers. They want to get them out of there quickly. We are going to continue monitoring that. If they're not able to, ultimately, though, they need to speed up the process and get these unaccompanied minors to relatives or even parents who are in the United States. Overwhelmingly, these children are coming to join relatives or parents. So we'll see how long it takes. They've been making progress. The Biden administration, to their credit, has been making progress, but it needs to continue and be quick.
So, Carolyn Donahoe, apparently the Biden administration has gotten down by 90% the number of kids in Customs and Border Patrol custody. I think they're at 735 children, but more than 22,000 are in HHS custody. What is the difference, and what do you think needs to happen to speed up this process?
Well, I can't speak directly to that process, but I can just say that, as Lee said, it does appear that they are working very hard to get children certainly out of CBP custody. We hope that they work just as hard to get them out of HHS custody. And I would argue that the overwhelming thread in this particular discussion is that we need to end Title 42. Which was the Trump-era policy that supposedly had a public health rationale for expelling immigrants, asylum seekers. And unfortunately, one of the ramifications of that is families are being forced to make the awful decision about sending their children over without them because the parents would be expelled, or as a family, they would be expelled. So we really need to look at how our overall policies are affecting asylum seekers across the board.
And the class action suit, Legal Earned, if you could explain it more fully, that the ACLU has brought.
On Title 42, Amy?
Yes.
Right. So we are negotiating with the Biden administration both on family separation and on Title 42. The Trump era policy said no asylum seekers, we're going to expel you without any due process or without an asylum hearing. Unfortunately, the Biden administration has kept that for families. It's allowing unaccompanied children in, but not families. We sued over the children. The Biden administration has backed down. We are suing over the families. We are now in negotiations with the Biden administration. I think we're getting a little impatient that they're continuing to expel families. We believe that there is no public health rationale, there never was, for expelling families. If they need to test people, so be it. If they need to quarantine people, that may be necessary at times. But you cannot use the public health laws as a pretext to send people back to danger. The Biden administration is allowing us to get the most vulnerable families in. But as Carol Ann said, often the family cannot get in. They're making this horrendous choice to deciding whether their child should go forward and at least save the child or keep the child with them. And so it's creating this sort of coercive self-separation. There are families in real danger with little children being sent back to really horrible situations, dangerous situations, Central America, Haiti, after they've fled danger. So we need the Biden administration to stop this. We need CDC to step up and say, we're not going to let CDC be used in this way. The Trump White House overrode the CDC. We are, surprised and troubled that the Biden CDC is not standing up to this, because the order is ultimately in CDC's name.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Legal Earned is the deputy director of the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project and the attorney leading the ACLU's lawsuit over family separations. And Caroline Donahoe, managing attorney for El Ultralado's Family Reunification Project. Thanks so much. When we come back, the man who lived underground. We'll go to Portugal to speak with Julia Wright about how she unearthed an unpublished novel about racist police violence written by her father, the legendary African-American writer Richard Wright, who wrote Native Son and Black Boy. Stay with us.
There's an old man called Mississippi. That's the old man that I'd like to be. What does he care if the world's got troubles? What does he care if the land ain't free? Old Man River, that Old Man River, he must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters, he don't plant cotton, and damn that planter is soon forgotten. But Old Man River, he just keeps rolling along.
Old Man River, sung by Paul Robeson, who had his passport taken by the U.S. government, who was blacklisted in this country, and was a friend of Richard Wright. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. By the way, you can watch, listen, and read transcripts using our iOS and Android apps. Download them for free from the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store today. Over 80 years ago, Richard Wright became one of the most famous black writers in the United States with the publication of his novel, Native Son. It sold over 200,000 copies in the first 3 weeks and inspired a generation of black writers. Amiri Baraka once said, quote, "Wright was one of the people who made me conscious of the need to struggle." In 1941, Richard Wright wrote a follow-up novel titled The Man Who Lived Underground. It centered on a black man who was forced to live in a city sewer system after being brutalized by white police officers who tortured him until he falsely admitted to murdering a white couple. But publishers rejected Wright's book. Portions of the book were turned into a short story of the same name, but the full novel, including the graphic descriptions of police brutality, went unpublished until now. Richard Wright once said of the novel, quote, "I've never written anything in my life that stemmed more from sheer inspiration or executed any piece of writing in a deeper feeling of imaginative freedom or expressed myself in a way that flowed more naturally from my own personal background, reading, experiences, and feelings." But his manuscript was largely forgotten until his daughter, Julia Wright, unearthed it at the Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Yale University and worked with the Library of America to have the book finally published nearly 80 years after it was written and 60 years after Richard Wright died at the age of 52 in Paris, where he had taken his family to live since 1946. Julia Wright is joining us now from Portugal, a longtime anti-death penalty activist, supporter of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and is writing a biography of her father. She is the executrix of his estate. We welcome you back to Democracy Now!, Julia. It's great to have you back after all of these years. Can you talk about the significance of what you found and how you finally have had it published?
Thank you, Amy, for having me back on the show. Yes, it was a very exciting discovery. I was living in Paris at the end of the 90s and during the early years of 2000, and I was learning the ropes of the estate with my mother, Ellen. I was also freelancing as a journalist there, and the time came after my mother's death to publish another work by my father. So since I would travel to the United States to visit death row and visit death row prisoners there, like Mumia Abu-Jamal, whose human rights were being so systematically violated, I would take the plane, land in the United States, go through cities like New York or Philly, Philadelphia, and go to death row. But on my way to death row, I would encounter another type of death sentence, and that is the shootings of unarmed black and brown people in our streets, also of vulnerable minorities like mentally challenged people. And I remember being absolutely shocked, for instance, by what happened to James Byrd down in Texas, who was dragged behind a white, I believe they were three, there were three of them, three white supremacists' van until he was dismembered. Alive, while he was still alive. I remember Abner Luima in New York and his sodomization. I remember in those years, as I was going to death row. Yes, absolutely, by the police, always by the police. And also, I remember Amadou Diallo shot by the police 40 times, not because he was the one suspected of rape. It was somebody else, but he was a convenient black target. So when I got to Yale and to Beinecke, and I have this memory of entering this very plush, comfortable, air-conditioned library in July of 2010 to look for a manuscript to publish. And I saw the long version of The Man Who Lived Underground. It leapt out at me as, I don't know what to say, a time bomb, a time machine, something that had to be published yesterday. I was so driven about it that I took it back to Paris and approached Library of America in those days it was still fax. And that's how the idea began.
And talk about the book. Talk about the descriptions of police violence. Talk about the man who went underground, who lived in the sewer system. Again, it was published as a short story, but not as a book because the publishers didn't want those graphic descriptions.
The publishers, who were white, it was controlled, white-controlled, did not want those descriptions of white supremacist police violence on upon a black man because it was too close to home. As one editor who rejected the long version of the manuscript said, it is too unbearable, quote unquote, too untenable, too uncomfortable. It's a bit like, you know, lifting the stone and not wanting the worms, the racist worms underneath to be seen. Very interestingly, Kevin Powell, a New York writer, very promising writer, commented on the long version the other day. What if those first 50 pages on police brutality had been accepted back in the day, all the discourse around that narrative that would have taken place all those years ago would perhaps have changed something, but it didn't.
I'm looking at a quote from The Man Who Lived Underground, your father's book. He says, outside of time and space, he looked down upon the earth and saw that each fleeting day was a day of dying, that men died slowly with each passing moment, as much as they did in war, that human grief and sorrow were utterly insufficient to this vast, dreary spectacle. And I'm thinking about the time we live in, Julia, right now, as you look across the Atlantic at your country, the United States, what happened to George Floyd last year, the police murder of George Floyd, and then the trial. Your thoughts?
My thoughts about the video that was taken by Darnella Frazier, such a young girl, fearlessly, even while she was being threatened, is a central, fundamental thing to our culture. Because, as Benjamin Crump said, as she did it, she recaptured part of our narrative that escaped us. And that narrative is the narrative of our death. Because that goes back to slavery, it goes back to the lynchings, it goes back to Black Boy Chapter 2, when Richard, aged 8 or 9, realizes that the grown-ups who are whispering above him are whispering about the lynching of his uncle, Silas Hoskins. And he doesn't understand. He wonders where the body is. He wonders why there are no flowers, why there's no funeral. And he says to his mother, why didn't we do anything about it? And those words reverberate through all these decades and seem to have reached Darnella as she filmed George Floyd's last moments. She did something about it. She filmed his last moments. She gave us a new narrative.
We're talking to Julia Wright, the daughter of the literary giant Richard Wright, so famous for his books Native Son and Black Boy. In 1951, Richard Wright actually starred in a film version of Native Son. He played the main character, Bigger Thomas. This is just a clip from the trailer.
All my life I heard of black men being killed because of white girls, and there I was.
Darling, give up. It might make it easier.
I felt free and wasn't scared no more. I was back home again. And there was my father, the white folks had killed when I was a kid.
How can I help you now?
You don't have to help me, Mr. Max. Go home. Now you can hate me like the others.
Again, that is Richard Wright playing Bigger Thomas in the film version of his book, the blockbuster bestseller at the time, Native Son. And then his kind of literary biography, Black Boy. Julia, especially for the younger generation, if you could give us a thumbnail biography of your father, of where your father grew up, how he moved north, how he wrote these books. And ultimately, I don't know if you describe it as fled the United States with you and your mother, right? Fled New York, fled the racism, as James Baldwin would do later, and ended up in Paris.
Oh, difficult, because I'm so close to what he did. I don't have that bird's eye view that I would like to have. But I would say that maybe he would prefer the word expatriate to exile, and he would prefer the word escape to flight, because they're more active words, and he thought of himself as more endowed with agency as time went on. Everything he did was to gain more freedom in his ability to create. You showed a clip of the film he invested so much of his energy into, writing, co-writing the script, being part producer of, acting bigger. And in the end, that film was censored because it was came out during McCarthyism. That was one of the reasons why he could not stay and create freely in a land where the pages he wrote about police brutality would be dismembered from his book, a bit in the way James Byrd would be dismembered. I mean, I use the word a bit violently, but in a way, it is the same thing. He needed freedom in all senses, in all meanings of the term. And so he went where he felt he could find it.
I mean, if you could talk about what he experienced here, also the HUAC hearings, watching Paul Robeson being destroyed by the U.S. government, this enormous talent, this giant figure, them taking his passport, the anti-communist fervor of the time, not wanting to the FBI to come to try to get him to spy on his colleagues, his relationships with James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison and Paul Robeson, the significance of this period.
It was the Cold War, and culture, academics, writers were used in the Cold War against one another. It was a terrible cloak and dagger period, but it was to the death of creativity, but also to the death of life. It was terrible. I remember my father's best friend, Ollie Harrington, who was a member of the CPUSA and the creator of Bootsy.
The Communist Party USA.
Yes, yes, yes. And he was the creator of Bootsy, a very famous cartoon. And he was my father's best friend to the end. My father used to tell Ollie, the apartment is bugged. It's both. And Ali used to laugh at my father. This was in Paris at the end.
Julia, we just have 20 seconds.
And Ali would laugh and say, no, no way. You're being paranoid, Richard. But Richard insisted, so Ali brought technicians in, and they found bugs.
Well, so, we're going to we have to leave it there. But people can pick up this latest book of the great literary giant Richard Wright. Thank you so much to his daughter, Julia Wright, The Man Who Lived Underground, just published. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.